Scary probably isn't the right word. Intimidating might be. It's the feeling that I had several years ago standing in the front yard working on the lawn when the man pulled into our driveway, got out of his car and walked up to me with an envelope in his hand and said, "Are you Paul Molnar?" And I said, I guess. And he said, "You, sir, are being served with a court summons. You are to appear before the judge next week." I was called as a witness in a very difficult court case. It ended up with me spending 2 days on the stand, serving as witness and sitting on that stand underneath a judge clothed in a robe, much like the one I'm wearing now, a judge with the power, the authority to do, it seemed like, anything that he wanted. Of course, I wasn't even the one that was going to be in trouble. I was just the witness. And I was still intimidated. It was still troubling to be in that context. It was as troubling to sit on the stand as it was to first receive the summons. Now imagine for a moment that you receive a summons. Not from some earthly judge, but from God. Imagine that a messenger of God came to you with a summons and said, "You are being called into the court of the Most High, where you must give an account for yourself." That'd be pretty intimidating, I think. That's what we have in Isaiah chapter 1. It is a summons for the nation. In verse 1, when it says, "Let them approach, let them speak, let us draw near for judgment," the Most High God is summoning the nations into His courtroom, where He is not only the judge, but also the prosecutor. Now, scholars have figured out and explained to us that in the ancient Near East, they used to have these treaties between a more powerful king and a less powerful king. And whenever with one of these treaties, the less powerful king failed to live up to his end of the bargain, the more powerful king would file what we would call a covenant lawsuit. And he would send a messenger with a summons, and this case would be tried and adjudicated that the person had not lived up to their side of the covenant. And that's what's happening in chapter 41. God, the great king, is calling all of the lesser kings of the earth into his courtroom because they have not kept up their end of the bargain. That's the charge. Covenant breaking. And we think to ourselves, how could the nations be guilty of covenant breaking? Israel could be guilty of covenant breaking, and the kings of Israel could break God's covenant. But what about these nations? They didn't have any obligations before God. Well, of course they did. Everyone has obligations before God. Not just his people, but everyone who has ever lived has obligations before God. People love to believe. You hear the excuse all the time that they're only responsible for what they know. But that's not the way reality works. Have you ever tried that with a police officer when he stops you for speeding? "Oh, was that the speed limit, officer? I wasn't so sure." It doesn't work. There's an expression in law. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. You're not responsible just for what you know. You're responsible for what has been made known. And so it is with God. People are not simply responsible for what they know. They're responsible for everything that God has made known. That's what Paul says in Romans chapter 1. He talks about the wrath of God being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and all unrighteousness. And he says that these men suppress the truth, for what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. So they are, Paul says, without excuse. They're guilty. The nations are being called into the courtroom because they are guilty. They have failed to recognize God for who He is. Isaiah here is going to expand on the point that he made in the last chapter. He had just made a couple passing comments about the nature of God in chapter 40. And in chapter 41, he'll expand on them. Remember, in the last chapter, he's declared that the Lord is sovereign over all the nations. He said, the nations are a drop in the bucket. He said in chapter 40 that the Lord is sovereign over all rulers of the earth. It is He who brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. He said in chapter 40 that there are no other gods. Remember, he asked the question, to whom shall you liken God? Isaiah is bringing all of these ideas and questions together to set before the nations one essential question. Who? Remember, the nations are, as they always are, in a time of tumult. Nations are rising, empires are falling, wars are taking place. And Isaiah asks the nations to consider who? Who is the cause of all of this? Who is the source for all that is? You see, God, through Isaiah, does not deny the significance of the events that take place in the world. He doesn't say that these events are meaningless, pay no attention to them. But he does declare his authority over them. And that's why the nations are guilty. They've seen what is taking place in the world. They've experienced what's happening. But they deny that God has authority over it all. They're guilty. They fail to obey Him. They fail to worship Him. To put that another way, they fail to glorify and enjoy Him. That is always the sequence. The response to seeing God clearly is worship and adoration. And the result of worship and adoration is that God is glorified and we enjoy Him. And the alternative that we'll see in the rest of this chapter, the alternative to glorifying God and enjoying Him forever, is death. Death by pride or death by fear, but death. This is why it's so remarkable that God reconciles us to Himself in Christ. It's so remarkable that when we are saved, to use that common language, what we are being saved from is the death that comes from being alienated from God. And so the nations are on trial. They're on trial because God has declared that He will not only vindicate His people, which He's talked about a bunch, but He'll vindicate Himself. He'll vindicate His covenant. He declares unequivocally that He is the foe from which none can escape. You can imagine all the rulers of these nations in their planning and their plotting and their scheming. They try to figure out, well, how will we overcome this foe? And how will we avoid that battle? And how will we win this conflict? And yet God makes it clear to them that they can escape those things all they like. There is no escaping God. Look at the end of verse 4 when it says, who has performed and done this? He says, I, the Lord, the first and with the last, I am He. And that phrase, I am He, is an important biblical phrase. It's not just, I am He who created, or I am He who did this, that, and the other. It's simply, I am. I am existence. Everything that is finds its existence and its being in me. Everything that happens finds its source in me. My authority, my sovereignty, my will is supreme above all. We talked about this several Sunday nights ago when we talked about the solitariness of God. To whom can you compare to the Lord? There's none. I am He, God says. He's absolute in His sovereignty. Everything is in Him. Paul takes that language and uses it beautifully in the first two chapters of Ephesians to connect God's declaration of sovereignty to what Christ has done for us. And for two chapters in Ephesians, Paul uses that in Him language to talk about what happens to those who are in Him. In Him we have redemption through His blood. In Him we have obtained an inheritance. In Him we were sealed with the promised Holy Spirit. In Him we who were far off have been brought near. In Him we have access to the Father. In Him we are being built together. Everything that happens in our lives for salvation and for the glory of God is in Him. Now, I don't think I have to sell you all on that. But I've tried to sell you out on that so that I can get you to believe what comes next. If we believe that He is sovereign and everything about our salvation and our growth in Christ and our glorification, if all of that is in Him, why is it that when we look at the political machinations and the military machinations and the rising and falling of nations in this world, we don't think that that's in Him too? Why are we so willing to accept as Christians and particularly as Reformed people that God is sovereign over me, but He has no idea what's going on in this world that's falling apart? Isaiah here declares that nations can plot and scheme. They can wring their hands and worry. They can rise and fall, but they cannot escape the reality that God is God. And He's sovereign over everything. Now, that's quite an opening statement that God has made in the courtroom. I don't know if you're allowed to rest your case after only an opening statement, but I think that perhaps God could. One other thing Isaiah does here that's very interesting is in chapter 41, he starts with a very similar phrase, actually the exact same phrase as he used at the end of chapter 40. You see, at the end of chapter 40, in verse 31, it says, "They who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength." And then in chapter 41, when he calls the nations together, he says, "Let the peoples renew their strength." The exact same phrases, but the meanings could not be more different. In chapter 40, God is calling on His people who are weak and weary with their trials, who are weak and weary with their sufferings, who are weak and weary with their fear and concern about the future. And He calls on them to give up their own strength and to renew their strength in God, to know that His strength will bring perseverance. And that's what God calls us to do. But here in chapter 41, He turns to the nations and He uses the exact same phrase, that they need to renew their strength. Only they've already rejected God. They have no intention of finding their strength in God. But God gives them fair warning. You better find some strength somewhere. Because if you reject Me, you go to war with Me. If you deny My sovereignty over all things, you are at enmity with Me and at war with Me. And you wonder if they recognize that that's what they're doing when they reject His sovereignty. You wonder if they understand that they are declaring war on God. I wonder if we understand that that's what we're doing when we reject His sovereignty. You say, "God, You can say whatever You want to say, but I really have to do these things to make stuff happen. So, God, Your promises and the words that You've said are fine, but I really got to get to work making some things happen here." That's declaring war on God. That's telling God, He's not the boss of you. We hear that a lot in my house. We don't want to say that to God. The crux of the matter, God's primary case here, is that He's bringing about history according to His purposes. Now, the specific circumstances that are talked about in verses 2 through 4, the one who is stirred up from the east, who is given victory, this is a prophecy about Cyrus. Now, the rule of Cyrus is just beginning when Isaiah utters these words. He's talking about something that is about to happen in the future. So the people know who Cyrus is, the rulers do, but they don't know just how powerful he's going to become. We'll learn more about Cyrus in a few chapters in Isaiah. You can read the whole story about Cyrus if you read Ezra and Nehemiah. But the cliff notes of Cyrus is pretty simple. He was the founder of the Persian Empire. He came basically out of nowhere. He had this small, tiny territory, and then he inherited some more territory, and then all of a sudden he was able to take over the known world. Babylon in 539 would fall to him without a fight. The great Babylonian Empire that put down the Assyrians, Babylon would fall to Cyrus without so much as a fight. Cyrus was a different kind of ruler, though, than many who had been seen in the world to this point. He took the approach of winning more flies with honey rather than vinegar. He was what I would call a political and a religious pragmatist. The Babylonians, whenever they conquered another nation, they destroyed all the temples, they destroyed all of the cultural elements and icons, they took the people out of their land, they sent them into captivity. They wanted essentially to wipe those nations out of the history books. But Cyrus did something very different. When he gained the Babylonian Empire, he sent all of these people back to their lands. He helped them rebuild their temples and rebuild their civic and social structures. He wanted them to be happy in their own culture because he thought that happy subjects would be loyal subjects. You read in Ezra and Nehemiah that he gave the money for the Jews' temple to be rebuilt. And this was, again, part of his pragmatism. He had taken over all of these nations and all of these cultures, and they had a bunch of different gods. Cyrus didn't know which god was true and which god was false. So he told all of these cultures, rebuild your temple, worship your god, pray to your god. And by the way, when you pray to your god for me. All of you, all your gods, let me cover all my bases. Let's just have everybody praying for me. That was Cyrus's way of ruling. Now, Isaiah will talk more about this in the coming passages, but when it talks in verses 2 through 4 about this one who is victorious, it is Cyrus. But he doesn't mention Cyrus specifically here. And he does that because he doesn't want us just to focus on Cyrus. He wants us to use this text as a blueprint for all of history. He wants this to be a framework for the rulers of the world and for the people of Israel and for us today to use to think about history. You know, the questions that we wonder about what's happening in the world today, those are not new questions. They're the same kinds of questions that people have wondered for thousands of years. They're the same kinds of questions that get asked in this very text. The beginning of verse 2, who stirred up one from the east, whom victory meets at every step? Where do people like Cyrus come from? These conquerors, these rulers, how do people rise to positions of power? Who has given them this kind of authority? Why do they get what they want? Why do they prosper? Why do they win? Why do certain nations rise while others fall? These are not new questions. They're the fundamental questions that are being asked here. And as one scholar summarizes it brilliantly, he says, in a word, who really rules the world? Is history a meaningless jumble of events? Or is it a plan in the hands of a master? That's really what this chapter is about. And it can be asked of anyone who has ever risen to power in the history of the world. Who brings them to power? And for what purpose? And I would say that it's when we fail to see the answer to this question, or when we forget, more likely, forget the answer to this question, that the political and the military machinations of this world lead us to fear and ultimately to idolatry. That is the pattern that God shows us in the response of the nations. It's a very predictable pattern, which is helpful because we can see what happens if you start with fear, where that leads you. And it's not only true for them, it's true for us today. So if you look at verses 5 through 7, you see the pattern of how the nations respond to all that's happening in the world. And Old Testament theologian Alec Moyer does a very good job of summarizing this for us. He says it starts with fear, universal fear. Look at verse 5. The coastlands have seen and are afraid. The ends of the earth tremble. People are afraid. They look at what's happening in the world and they're scared. They're nervous. They're anxious. That leads to what he calls collective security. People coming together. It says at the end of verse 5, they have drawn near and come. Everyone helps his neighbor and says to his brother, be strong. You notice that what brings them together, what unites them, is not a solution. It's their fear. They're not bound together by a shared commitment to God. They're not bound together by an understanding of reality. They are only coming together because they are afraid. And they want to say to one another, be strong. Don't be afraid. We'll get out of this. We'll come up with a solution. And that's what they do. They create a solution. The craftsman strengthens the goldsmith, and he who smooths the hammer, him who strikes the anvil, saying of the soldering, it's good, and they strengthen it with nails so that it cannot be moved. Do you know what they've done? They've built an idol. People came together in their fear, and they developed a solution. They created an answer to their problem. They created an idol. Because you know, that's really the problem with human-made solutions. You can't make anything that's better than yourself. The human product cannot exceed its source. It may come from human skill. It may come with human approval. It may have human stability that we cannot move it. And yet human gods are only projections of human weaknesses. And that is idolatry. Now remember that common progression, because it's key, and I bet it's familiar to us. Fear. It all starts with fear. Fear is the socially acceptable sin, even within the church. Of course, we don't call it fear. We're not afraid. We have concerns. Or we're not so sure about, or we wonder what will happen. You see, we're afraid. And we battle this in all of life. When it comes to our health and well-being, when it comes to our finances and economic stability and employment. But right now, this particular season in our country, it's magnified in the realm of politics. What will happen if the elections go this way? What will happen if so-and-so is elected? Fear. Fear leads to self-sufficiency. Since there's a problem to be solved, we need a solution. In the absence of reliance upon God, we'll develop a solution. We'll create a solution. The craftsman, the goldsmith, the carpenter, we'll all work together to create something that will solve this problem. And that's why self-sufficiency always leads to idolatry. Because any solution that we make is an idol. Anything that seeks to bring hope or comfort, or answers about the future that is not from the mouth of God, is by definition an idol. We all want hope for the future. We all want security. But security can only come from two places: the mouth of God or idols. That's it. The nations are on trial here because time and time again they look to idols for their hope and their security. They look to idols to guide the course of history. But it's not just the nations that are guilty of this, is it? We hear the stories. We see the pattern. But have we learned anything? Are we not prone to the same dangerous progression? We have fear. We have fear about the world. We look at this economy. We look at this culture. What has happened to this culture? We look at this election. And we're afraid. And it causes us to begin to grasp for man-made solutions. Well, if this candidate is in office, we have hope and a future. If that candidate is taken out of office, we can survive. But that, my friends, is self-sufficiency. It's idolatry. God calls us to remember what He has made known. He has sent a messenger. He has put us on trial. He says, "Do you not know? I am bringing about history according to my purposes." It's not that the questions are illegitimate. Actually, I would say that we should not be satisfied until we get an answer to those questions. Who is bringing all of this about? Who is behind the wheel? Who is making this happen? Those are questions that need an answer. Isaiah sets up this passage in a way that brings those questions to the forefront. Why did the concept of warring nations start in the first place? Why is one person allowed to rise to power? Or as one scholar put it, why is it all such a mess? We need answers to these questions. The problem is not the questions. The problem is that God has given us the answer and that we forget it. God is at work. He says, we may not understand how to connect the dots. He freely grants that when we look at a particular moment in history, we look at a particular ruler or a particular nation, and we may not be able to figure out why God did that or what exactly God was doing in that moment. That may not be for us to know. But what we can know is this: it was God. There is no one in the history of the earth who comes to power unless God grants it. No one. And to say anything else is to declare war on His sovereignty. God is at work. The question for us is, are we going to be okay with fear? Knowing that fear leads to self-sufficiency, which leads to idolatry. Knowing that the antidote to fear is so simple, it's recognizing God's sovereignty and believing what He has said. Are we going to be okay with fear? Are we going to continue to use this language of anxiety and wringing our hands about the future as if there is not a sovereign God in control? The Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 3, paragraph 1, says it best. If there is any one section of the Westminster Confession of Faith you ought to memorize, it's this one sentence. God, from all eternity, did by the most wise and holy counsel of His own will, freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass. Those are perhaps the most encouraging and comforting words in all of the confession. And they apply to every circumstance, whether it's personal fear, our health, our provision, our relationships, or whether it's political turmoil and confusion. These are the words of comfort that He has unchangeably ordained whatsoever comes to pass. This cannot and does not answer the question of why God allows a particular ruler or a particular moment in human history. No one can answer that but God Himself. But knowing that God is sovereign answers the underlying and the far more important question that I asked before. Is history a meaningless jumble of events, or is it a plan in the hands of a master? If it's the former, if it's the meaningless jumble of events, then fear and self-sufficiency and idolatry make sense because we got to do something to make the best of a bad situation. But if it's the latter, if history, all of history, is the working out of God's sovereign purposes, if He is master over it all, then what are we afraid of? Why are we so anxious? What do we do? How do we escape this pattern of human fear? Well, the first thing is clear. It's come to terms with reality that God is sovereign. One pastor looking at this passage told his congregation that nations pretend they have power, but that's all they do is pretend. The ultimate authority in this universe does not reside in Babylon. It does not reside in Persia. It does not reside in Greece or Rome, but in the God of Israel. And I would wonder if we can add Raleigh and Washington, D.C. to that list. The fact that God is sovereign over all of reality is not just to condemn the unbelievers who are on trial in this passage. Go back to chapter 40 and remember that all of this, the rest of Isaiah, is about giving comfort to God's people. Find your comfort in the fact that our God is in control of whatsoever comes to pass. That's why Isaiah, beginning with verse 8, says, "But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen." God begins to speak with affection to His people. We think the president is so powerful. We think that what the governor does is so significant. We think that our hope and our future in this world is tied up in the hands of a few Supreme Court justices. Isaiah doesn't deny the significance of the events that happen in this world. But he declares unequivocally that God is sovereign and has authority over all of them. What do we do about these elections? Well, we participate faithfully, but without putting our hope in men. That's the tightrope that we have to walk as citizens of this kingdom and citizens of another kingdom. We participate faithfully without putting our hope in men. Hear this very clearly. To declare that our nation will be saved or condemned because of a particular election of a particular person is idolatry. To believe that there is a person or a group of people who can save a nation is idolatry. Pastor Derek Thomas points out that God is warning us here that we are never so vulnerable as when we believe ourselves to be strong in our own strength. And this is perhaps what gets nations like ours in trouble, giving men and women credit and power that only belongs to God. We should also pray. I had coffee with a dear friend this week, and I thought he put it really well when he said that we ought to be praying for God to be merciful in this election. Since it is God that raises up all rulers, and he raises some up for blessing, and he raises some up for judgment, we ought to pray that God would be merciful to us in whomever he raises up. We should pray for our rulers to rule well. But I would also add to this, that I think Christians ought to spend more time praying that we as the church would maintain our focus. Friends, our kingdom is not of this world. Our solution is not primarily for the nations of this world. Our solution is for the problem of people needing to be reconciled, of hopeless and wayward sinners who need to be reconciled to a holy God. And who holds elected office has no bearing on the good news of the gospel. It has no bearing on the solution to the greatest problem the world has ever known. There is only one man, and it is the God-man, who can solve the world's fundamental problem, which is enmity toward God. Only the God-man can bring true restoration to this world. So no matter how we vote, no matter how involved we get, let's make sure that we don't confuse categories by giving a human election more credit than it deserves. The question for us is, how can I live without fear in this world? Whether I wake up in a couple of months to a President Obama, or I wake up in a couple of months to a President Romney, how can I live without fear in this world? And the answer is, believe what God has said. I am the Lord, the first and with the last. I am He. There is no one who can stay His hand. There is no one who can thwart His purposes. And there is no one who can condemn this world beyond Christ's ability to redeem it. Our God has spoken. Will we believe His promises?